This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, updating the count and the cases. We expect Georgia to report their tally of their hand recount today.
Yeah, they finished last night at midnight.
And yet again, yesterday we had another curious incident. This brought to our attention from by David Schaefer, who's the head of the Republican Party in the state of Georgia. One of our monitors discovered a 9,626 vote error in DeKalb County, the hand count. One batch was labeled 10,707 for Biden and 13 for Trump, an improbable margin even by DeKalb standards. The actual count for the batch was 1,081 for Biden and 13 for Trump. So added a zero and a couple of other numbers where they weren't appropriate. So 9,626 vote error in DeKalb County. That was the, in addition to some of the memory cards that were discovered in three other counties. Now, again, based on no other information being reported of such incidents yesterday, the expectation is that the count at the end of the day, as will be reported today in Georgia, still will favor Joe Biden. But it certainly raises material issues about the administration of the elections in Georgia, and it's I think adds further legitimacy to President Trump's decision yesterday to finance a recount in two counties in the state of Wisconsin, obviously Milwaukee County and Dane County, the two biggest Democrat counties in Wisconsin.
But do you think that's worth the money? I mean, do you think he should keep fighting President Trump?
312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA turnkey.pro text line.
Or is it over?
I know there's this zeitgeist to declare it over, and I don't know why they're so impatient. So I just want to understand the standards here from the D.C. press corps and the Democrat Socialist Party, for which they serve as the comm shop. So you can go 4 years making accusations that you can't substantiate. And that's fine, and it certainly doesn't undermine the legitimacy of our republic. You can, on the other hand, pursue your legal rights in courts of law in full public view on the timeline as set forward, and that is delegitimizing our republic. Do I have that right? Hillary Clinton was up until about yesterday saying President Trump is an illegitimate president. She never pursued her legal rights for recounts in 2016. She certainly could have.
Yeah, she chose not to.
Or other allegations of Russian collusion with the Trump administration or Russian interference in the election. I know those Facebook ads were so determinative. She chose not to do that, and yet she can call him an illegitimate president, as can so many in the left for 4 years. That does not and in any way imperil the republic. President Trump, pursuing his legal rights through the processes and institutions that have been created for people to pursue their legal rights in such matters as an election, in furtherance of legitimizing the electoral process in this country, that is destabilizing. That is a threat to the republic. That is imperiling America's future.
Well, I just want to make sure we have secure elections that are not fraudulent moving forward. So, yes, these votes that are turning up for Trump, these three memory cards that contain votes that we're missing, it's not enough to overturn the final results in the state, but let's get this right for the next time.
Well, by the way,
and especially for the runoff election, which, by the way, they started to mail in the ballots already.
The matter here in Georgia, you know, before this DeKalb County incident that was reported yesterday, this discovery in DeKalb County, you know, there was a 1,200 vote swing because of the memory cards found in other counties that hadn't been processed. That's about 8% of the spread between the two candidates. That is not inconsequential. those are substantial errors, and I'm, you know, giving them the benefit of the doubt that it was just errors. Yep. Oh, by the way, the spread in DeKalb County, speaking of spreads,
right?
David Schaefer, the state party chairman there, made the point that the margin of victory in DeKalb County for Joe Biden was 99.9%. Which was better than Bashar al-Assad's 2007 margin in Syria, where he won only 97.6% of the vote, or Raul Castro's 2008 margin in Cuba, where he won only 99.4% of the vote in those free and fair elections in Cuba. It did match Kim Jong-il's 2009 margin in North Korea of 99.9%. So DeKalb County residents would be very comfortable in Pyongyang, apparently.
How do you lose these memory cards? I mean, in Floyd County, in Fayette County, I don't know how that happens. And they don't explain how it happens, but they just popped up and now they're loading them in.
There's something else. This was the other evening. You know, these charges that are still being leveled by Sidney Powell, who I will repeat is a serious person and a pretty accomplished appellate attorney. And then sort of being echoed by other representatives of the Trump campaign. What is the rush to just dismiss them out of hand? I don't know if they're true. They are substantial claims, big claims. They may turn out to not be true. Sidney Powell is staking her credibility as an attorney on these claims. Aren't you interested to find out why she would stake something as prized as her reputation as an attorney on claims as serious as this? You can't wait 2 weeks. You can't let the process play itself out and see what she can prove up in both courts and the rest of the legal team, in both courts of law and courts of public opinion. Why the rush? Everybody's in such a hurry. Oh, I know. It's because the transition needs to happen on Joe Biden's timeline. Just as the president gets to be president until November 3rd, this was something that was news to so many Democrats. So with respect to the Amy Coney Barrett nomination, you can't nominate. Well, I'm still the president. There's a vacancy. That's what I do. He's still the president until January 20th. He still gets to be the president. He's still making decisions, you know, like pulling 2,000 troops out of Afghanistan. He still gets to make decisions along with members of Congress to the extent they want to be involved in the decision making process on important issues. So This point that was made by a campaign surrogate Brian Trasher, I think is his name, on Newsmax the other night. Listen to what he said about what they have with respect to allegations of voter fraud by the voting system manufacturers, the companies that make the machines as well as the software.
Yeah, Sean, and that's just one of many examples that we found throughout all of these so-called swing states that were close in the election count. But, you know, Amanda nailed it just now, outlining the irregularities and potential fraud we've seen done manually by human beings. But now that we have seized the servers for Dominion that were over in Germany, and we're starting to get some raw data off of that. I know you guys have a huge audience now, Sean. Congratulations for that. But I want everybody to listen to me. The things that are going to come out are going to shake the globalists to their very core. And when President Trump is declared the winner of this election, what you saw last weekend in the streets, Trump supporters getting attacked in D.C., that's nothing. These people are coming for every city and every suburb, so be prepared because this is happening and you need to protect yourself.
Brian, let me go back to you. You said things are going to come out. What things?
Well, like I said, the servers that were seized in Germany, first of all, why are American election ballots being counted overseas? That's a question that we have to get to the bottom of. But some of the raw data coming off of this is showing clear examples of how votes were actually switched by an algorithm in the software. It was distributed for every single vote that go one way for one candidate. They automatically add votes another way. That's why you saw even the New York Times own data tracker on election night. Within 68 seconds, President Trump went from being ahead by tens of thousands of votes I think it was in Wisconsin, to all of a sudden being behind 10,000 votes in 68 seconds. That's a statistical anomaly. It cannot happen.
So what you're pointing to specifically, you think a bombshell announcement is going to happen with Dominion voting systems, the software that was used on Dominion specifically. Is that correct? Is that what I'm reading?
The fact that Dominion and Smartmatic have become household names in America is freaking the Democrats out. You can see them on Twitter. You can see the media melting down, just absolutely amplifying their false claims that there's no evidence. There's evidence that's being filed in courts all over the country. And today is the first time that we're actually going to be appearing in federal court. All these little suits that got dismissed here and there were all state courts run by Democrat hack judges. So we're about to see the real deal start, and this is going all over the Supreme Court, Sean.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Picking up our discussion on the voting systems, the vendors, Dominion Systems, and Smartmatic. You heard before Mike Scott's newscast from that Trump campaign surrogate making a specific allegation that I haven't heard made previously about the servers where the votes were counted. So here's what we know. Dominion and Scorecard are the software used to count the ballots in about 30 states and also another number of countries around the world. Sitel is the international company that acts as a clearinghouse for the voting data. The data is harvested from elections in each state in the United States and then sent real time to the servers in the Sitel cloud in Spain and Germany, which is what Brian Trasher from the Trump campaign was referencing. This is where the Trump allegations go, the vote was manipulated in favor of Biden and to the detriment of Trump. Just trying to zero in on where they're suggesting the fraud or the hacking of the election occurred. And from the allegations they're making, that's the translation. That's where they're suggesting it happened. But the one thing that we hadn't heard, we heard rumors about, but this seems to be confirmed by the Trump campaign surrogate, is that those Sitel servers the servers in the Sitel cloud in Spain and Germany have been seized by the military or by the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. There were rumors of the confiscation of those servers, and it sounded a bit far-fetched at first. I don't know if it still sounds far-fetched, but the Trump campaign is embracing it, so one would believe they have some evidence that they would know if that's true. The internet has a lot greater reach than many of the main media outlets, or really all the main media outlets combined. So he's essentially saying that the Trump campaign has the Sitel server data and proof that the presidential election was hacked by Dominion voting systems. That's what he's saying will bring the quote unquote anti-globalists to their knees. Now, that's a little bit of overheated rhetoric that's probably unnecessary. Just stick to what you suggest you have and what you suggest it implicates. There's also this, a whistleblower. This is a whistleblower with respect to Smartmatic. And the relationship between Smartmatic and Dominion's voting system seems to be in some public dispute because they've sort of disavowed one another in terms of any business relationship. But there's other reporting that suggests that that one was the subsidiary of the other, and now they're saying that they're competitors. Well, so even that notwithstanding, this whistleblower who provided a sworn affidavit, the circumstances and events of 2020 in America are eerily reminiscent of what happened with Smartmatic software electronically changing votes in the 2013 presidential election in Venezuela. And remember, Smartmatic is essentially a Hugo Chavez-founded company. The whistleblower goes on. I'm alarmed because what is occurring in plain sight during this 2020 election for President of the United States, what happened in the United States was that the vote counting was abruptly stopped in five states using Dominion software. I want to point out that the software and fundamental design of the electronic electoral system and software of Dominion and other election tabulating companies relies on software that is a descendant of the Smartmatic electoral management system. Importantly, I was a direct witness to the creation and operation of an electronic voting system in a conspiracy between a company known as Smartmatic and the leaders of conspiracy within the Venezuelan government. Chavez was most insistent that Smartmatic design the system in a way that the system could change the vote of each voter without being detected. Smartmatic agreed to create such a system and produce the software and hardware that accomplished that result for President Chavez. After the Smartmatic electoral management system was put in place, I closely observed several elections where the results were manipulated using Smartmatic software. One such election was in December of 2016, December of 2006. Another was in April of 2013, and he goes on. So, again, is that proof that this election was hacked, that Dominion changed vote tallies? No. It's proof of or it's evidence of a vulnerability. And again, based on whatever they are asserting they have, they believe that that vulnerability was exploited. And it seems to me that's a question that should be answered. That's something that should be included in complaints before courts of law and evidence presented to ascertain whether or not the Trump campaign is correct and they have the manifest weight of the evidence on their side. I mean, if you're interested in protecting American elections from being hacked by enemies, foreign or domestic.
Seems like the time to do it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
John Solomon from Just the News, justthenews.com, on with Lou Dobbs the other day, talked a little bit more about Dominion voting systems and what the records reflect.
Dominion was a donor to the Clinton Foundation. It's tied to the Democratic establishment through things like that. It was actually the Clinton Global Initiative, which was an arm of the foundation. It did hire as a lobbyist Nancy Pelosi's former top chief aide. So it is integrated into the Democratic establishment. It's also integrated into the bureaucratic establishment through these security establishments in the Homeland Security Department. So this is a Democrat establishment connected company. Now it has people on all sides of the fence, but its Democratic roots are there.
And so here's the scenario that John Solomon also is suggesting needs to be explored. Here's a scenario that's possible. This isn't conspiracy theorizing. Not making definitive statements. We're providing a backstory on these companies, the genesis of their products are, what vulnerabilities their products have, according to IT professionals, and what is a possible scenario that needs to be played out.
Thus far, we have not found any evidence that computers change votes specifically. But Dominion's system was primed for people to understand how they could use it and calculate, hey, President Trump's up at 20,000 votes at 11 o'clock at night. Let's find 20,000 votes somewhere and run them through the system in the dark of night. That is a scenario that when we talk to voters, election observers, even some city election workers in Philadelphia and Detroit, that appears to be a realistic scenario. And I think we'll find out that Dominion, beyond its Democratic connections, its systems gave the Democratic establishment machines in these cities the capability to find votes late to try to make up a difference. I think that's the narrative we may find out to be true when we keep digging.
And again, you heard it here on this show on Monday. Smartmatic had a role in Cook County elections in 2006. And there were questions raised about a system that Sequoia, which was ultimately bought by Smartmatic. Point was, Ed Burke was talking about this company. Alderman Ed Burke saying that they have ties to the Venezuelan government. They were involved in Venezuelan sham elections. And so they could be attempting to undermine our democracy. That was Ed Burke saying it. at Burke now part of the vast right wing conspiracy 14 years ago? And there were others in the Senate and the House, Democrats, who raised questions about what Ron Wyden, a Democrat senator from Oregon, called the voting machine lobby. The voting machine lobby, led by the biggest company, ES&S, and there's only three companies, really, believes they are above the law. They have not anybody hold them accountable, even on the most basic matters. Now, remember, prior to the 2020 election, and even prior to the 2018 election, all the concern was about election integrity for, you know, as it relates to preventing hacking, interference from Russia mainly, but from foreign adversaries. But there's no possibility that a domestic adversary, perhaps with foreign ties, could be involved in trying to manipulate the election in favor of a party that has and a press and every cultural institution in America that went all in to take out Trump. That's not possible. I'm not saying it happened. I'm saying, is it beyond the realm of possibility? The evidence that's being presented, the questions that are being raised, is it interesting to you? Is it legitimate, the questions being raised? I think so. I think so. Oh, and by the way, it was just last year, John Oliver, the insufferable host of one of these insufferable HBO shows, if you don't find Politically Incorrect lobotomizing enough, you can watch Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. But he actually did a very interesting piece last year on unsecure voting machines in America. Very concerned about unsecure voting machines. John Oliver, hard leftist.
As you'll see tonight, leaving our voting machines in the middle of Moscow, or indeed the middle of America, might not be the best idea, because a Senate report found that some of our voting equipment is aging and vulnerable to exploitation by a committed adversary. So tonight, let's talk about our voting machines. And first, you should know, there is no single standard voting system in this country. In some places, you vote by filling out a paper ballot and feeding it into a machine. At others, you press a button, get a printout, and then have that scanned into a different machine. And at still others, you press a touchscreen, and that's it. That's the whole voting process. And while that last option may seem like the best, it's actually, for reasons that we'll get into later, the absolute worst.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, unless you happen to personally know everyone who votes for you on a paperless DRE machine, there is no way to verify the results. It's a pretty good case against them, which makes it, frankly, completely insane that New Jersey not only still uses them, but plans to keep using them for the 2020 election. And it's not just New Jersey. In 2016, 20% of voters voted on paperless DREs, and an estimated 12% will use them in 2020, meaning 16 million Americans spread out across all these states are set to be voting on machines that pretty much everyone agrees are deeply, deeply flawed. And if they malfunction, there could be no way of knowing.
Or if they're hacked, DRE, direct recording electronic voting machines that don't have a paper printout. And then
I've always hated those. And I've never trusted them.
This is really fun. Yeah. Listen to John Oliver agreeing with President Trump.
Because what we have to do here is obvious. It's so obvious, in fact, even this guy understands it.
One of the things we're learning is it's always good. It's old-fashioned, but it's always good to have a paper backup system of voting. It's called paper, not highly complex computers, paper. And a lot of states are doing that.
Yeah. He's right. That's it. He's just all the way completely right.
And now John Oliver, of course, is suggesting that that Trump is imperiling the Republic just like every other leftist by not conceding the election. But that was John Oliver in 2019 doing a deep dive on the integrity of voting systems that are used in the 50 states. And his concern was Russia. But I say again, the concern is a technical one. It's one of integrity. So it doesn't necessarily take a foreign adversary to take advantage of that vulnerability, does it? Steve and Gary, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Love yeah, that. Good morning, Dan and Amy. This it's amazing. You go from conspiracy to Hollywood script, and the timing for everything, if the evidence is there. I mean, I'm an evidence guy on it as much as I feel on emotion like everyone else. They got it. They got to present it. Should have been yesterday, definitely today, but not tomorrow. So it's either time to or get off the pot, as they say.
Well,
have a good day.
Thanks for the call, Steve. It's time to do that according to the process and the time allotted. And the time allotted is not tomorrow. It's not. The recount going on that's been initiated now in Wisconsin of Milwaukee and Dane counties, that won't be completed until December 1st. Okay. The electors certifying the presidential result won't be until December 14th. So why does it have to be tomorrow? Why should it have been yesterday? Right? Why can't the Trump campaign take their allotted time to go through courts of law, to make their case in courts of public opinion and not be subjected to hysteria about undermining the republic? It's ridiculous. The timeline is the timeline. So let's see what the Trump campaign produces. What is unreasonable about that position when everything is being done in the light of day, at least with respect to challenging the results? Clearly, that wasn't the case with administering the elections and tabulating the results, as we're finding out. Charlotte in Arlington Heights.
Hi. Could congressional races be affected? For instance, the Oberweis race or the Ives race. They were winning on election night, and then these votes keep coming in. And, they lose.
Well, those were mail-in ballots.
Thanks for the call, Charlotte.
But that's a good question, can it?
I mean, if you can hack the system, then you can hack the system to change votes and for one race, then you can do it for another race. I'm not suggesting any of this has happened. I'm not suggesting this has happened, even at the presidential level. We're suggesting what's possible, and we're raising concerns about the impartiality of some of the players involved with the administration of elections in particular jurisdictions and with respect to particular vendors. I'm sorry, what is the problem with that? Why is that unreasonable? These people are beyond reproach? Is that what we're supposed to believe? Beyond reproach. Nobody's beyond reproach. Nobody is. Nor should they be in a free society. Jim and Joliet.
Yeah, good morning. For those people who want to just throw up their hands and say, well, you know, we should accept this. I mean, if you're a Democrat, obviously you want this to go through as it is right now, regardless of whether it's true or false. But if you're a Republican and you're saying, well, you know, we should just, you know, let it go and be done with it, that's just cowardice. And you, what you're doing is you're accepting not only a flawed election, you're accepting all the things that come with that election, including a loss of your personal civil rights and an embrace of Marxism. That's what's on the line here. It's too important. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, you go back, if you know, for the enterprising reporter, not that there are very many of those left, not at least in D.C. press corps outlets, but you take a walk down memory road. I mean, these companies have track records. I mentioned Smartmatic in the Cook County election in 2006. There's a story out of Florida, Palm Beach County, where county election, this is 2012, county election supervisor Susan Butcher, who insisted a computer glitch rather than human error was to blame for the fiasco of votes being assigned to the wrong candidates and the elections of the elections office in Palm Beach County declaring the wrong winners in two recent council races. She insisted it was a computer glitch rather than human error, claimed vindication after Dominion Voting Systems released its statement, essentially saying that, yes, there was a problem, and it was a computer error.
And we're still using those systems.
Yes. And mistakes can be made. It can be incompetence. It can be an honest mistake. Those things can absolutely happen. Own them. Explain them. That's the way you build confidence that you're dealing on the level. Don't hide them. Try to shut everybody up and say no questions asked are legitimate. Just accept the result as you're given and ask no questions, make no cases. No. Uh-uh. Joe in Arlington Heights.
Hey, good morning. Great show, as always. I'm pessimistic, Dan.
Yeah, well, it's a long shot. I think it's a long shot, but it's always been a long shot.
It is, and the reason that I'm particularly pessimistic is I want to know what happened to the Durham report.
Yeah.
I want to know what's going on.
Report?
There's no report.
What happened to the Durham investigation? It just dissipated into the ether.
Exactly.
I know.
Upset President-elect Biden. Yeah, please.
There appeared to be so much potential evidence that was being assembled, and the number of books that have been written, the great work that's been done by John Solomon and others, and now it's in the ether. It's disappeared. This is even a bigger scandal. Yeah. How do we get to the bottom of it?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I suppose we should talk about these new federal indictments yesterday of Madigan, Madigan friends and lobbyists, starting with Mike McClain, who really has been sort of central to this entire investigation into ComEd-related corruption. Yesterday, John Lausch, U.S. Attorney for the Northern District, indicting ComEd's former CEO and Premajori, Mike McClain, ComEd lobbyist and former state legislator from Quincy, who is a close, long time and close confidant of Mike Madigan, as well as Jay Doherty, who is a lobbyist, known in political circles for being a longtime leader of the City Club of Chicago, where I've spoken a number of times. And I know Jay. And
yeah, I've met him, too.
I like Jay. And he's a nice guy. I have no idea what his business dealings were, but I'm sorry to see that this has transpired. And longtime ComEd executive lobbyist John Hooker, who everybody in Springfield would know, you know, one of the rail creatures. Both sides, by the way. This is about Madigan, but it's certainly not limited to Madigan. It's not limited to the Democrat Party. This is a story about the, to borrow from John Cass, the bipartisan combine. That's what this is really about. And, of course, Mike Madigan sits at the top of the bipartisan combine. Right. So that's a good place to aspire to, which is where the U.S. Attorney's Office is going. Here's the interesting thing. You know, does Mike Madigan really get picked off in this case? Maybe. Maybe. I was skeptical at first. I'm getting less skeptical. In the 50-page indictment that was released, it was further part of the conspiracy that public official A, that would be Madigan, and McClain sought to obtain from ComEd jobs, vendor contracts, and subcontracts, as well as monetary payments for various associates of public official A. The individuals are charged with bribery, conspiracy, bribery, and willfully falsifying ComEd books and records. Well, the willfully falsifying ComEd books and records, that really won't have anything to do with Madigan, it wouldn't seem. But bribery and bribery conspiracy, well, if you're being charged with bribery, who are you bribing? And they would ultimately have exposure for participating in bribery as well, illegal bribery. And when per the indictment, further part of the conspiracy that public official A and McClain sought to obtain from ComEd jobs, vendor contracts, and subcontracts, as well as monetary payments for various associates of public official A. They were the bribers and he was the bribee. That's how it reads to me. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Isn't this exciting or do you even care? Do you even care if Mike Madigan goes to jail? I don't know where people are at. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line.
Well, I don't think it's if. I think it's when he goes to jail, because it's going to happen. And I think that they're putting these charges against people close to his circle in order to try and get them to flip and turn against Mike Madigan.
Well, right.
That's the ultimate goal.
Well, of course. But the fact that they were indicted rather than serving as cooperating witnesses against Madigan indicates starting with McClain, that they're not cooperating, that they're not being cooperating with the feds to pursue Madigan.
I mean, but there's always hope if they level even more charges against them that they might flip and be a witness for the government. But
that actually, that's not a hope. I don't believe in manufacturing charges to get people to flip. That's not justice. The question is, in these proceedings, you know, I mean, they're pleading, they're saying they're not guilty. Of course, this is pro forma.
Right,
but as this proceeds and they're facing real jail time, I mean, Mike McClain, 73 years old, will the pressure build and will they reflect on
maybe
their
they
potential time in jail and say, you know what, I'm going to cooperate and I'm going to help send Mike Madigan away if they have evidence that would be dispositive of Madigan's guilt in this scheme.
Well, Mike Madigan is losing support of Democratic leaders. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Governor Pritzker have said, you know, he should step down. Somebody else should lead. But who would that other person be, and would they be doing the same stuff that he's doing?
Well, of course they're running from a sinking ship.
Yes.
Of course they are. I mean, that's what happens in a den of thieves, which is what Springfield is generally and what the Democrat Socialist Party is in Chicago and Cook County specifically. Of course they are. No, because, you know, all those guys are good government guys now.
Of course.
All those guys that were
don't look at me.
Flying
look
in formation with Mike Madigan for the last half century, they're all good government guys now. They got what Mike Madigan involved in something corrupt? What? Oh, that's stunning. No. Well, I can't abide that. No, of course not.
What, the longest serving House Speaker in the country?
In American history.
American history, yeah. Way to go.
And so
we're doing so well.
And so these state legislators that are, you know, oh, it's time for Mike Madigan, and, you know, all the way on up to Pritzker. It's time for Mike Madigan to step down, and time for new leadership in the House. You know, of course, they want him to go away because he's become a political liability, but he's still a political potentate, so he's not going to go away. And the biggest political potentate, arguably still, although he's been weakened significantly because of this and because of Pritzker's money, doesn't need Madigan. But he does need him for political infrastructure still. So, you know, it's something you got to have to gently dance around, much like is the case with Ed Burke, who's awaiting trial sometime in 2042 or something, I believe. But your question, and we've tackled this before. Well, Mike Madigan is taken away in cuffs. No more Mike Madigan as House Speaker. And then what do you have?
Yeah, then what do we have? We still have billions of dollars of debt.
This is getting Joey the Clown.
System.
This is getting Joey the Clown Lombardo or mob bosses in their 80s. All the damage has been done. So yes, I mean a reckoning. I appreciate a reckoning, long overdue. But all the damage has been done. And what replaces Mike Madigan? I don't know. For instruction, what replaced John Cullerton? Transactional hack politician, part of the combine. Former Senate President John Cullerton. He retires in advance of all of this ugliness, right?
Mm-hmm.
To avoid the Fed's guillotine himself. And who replaces John Cullerton? A Marxist from Oak Park named Don Harmon. So you've gone from a transactional hack politician looking to leverage his office for personal gain, like a John Cullerton, like a Mike Madigan. And by the way, on the Republican side, like a Jim Durkin, like a Bill Brady, they're just not as good at it.
Oh, Durkin, by the way, this morning is asking Mike Madigan to step down.
It's the same thing. They're just not as good at it. They're in bed with the same people. They're involved in the same scheming and the same leveraging of office for personal gain. No. I mean, Jim Durkin, he's a municipal attorney who's the House super minority leader, right? So he's, on the one hand, involved in decision making for state, for municipal related issues that are tackled by the state, including funding issues. On the other hand, he's pitching his wares as a municipal attorney. There's no inherent conflict of interest there, just like there's no inherent conflict of interest with Mike Madigan serving as a property tax appeals attorney while being House Speaker. Of course not. No conflicts of interest at all exist in Illinois. But so what replaces Mike Madigan, particularly with what has become of the Democrat Socialist Party nationally as well as Illinois? I'll tell you what replaces him, a socialist. So you get an ideological socialist to replace a transactional combine kleptocrat. Is that an improvement? Will that lead to an improvement in Illinois? No, it won't, is the answer. The only thing that will improve is power will be diffused away from the Speaker's office a bit because Mike Madigan has built a machine over the last 50 years that somebody's not just simply going to inherit, and all of those people that were on the Madigan dole will just then fold over into the new speaker, and that operation will be the same politically as it's been low these many decades. No, you'll have a weakened Democrat socialist political arm. But the damage has already been done politically, too. You don't have a Republican Party in this state. So, again, tell me how this is going to usher in a new era in Illinois. Because that's what's being advertised. That's the only thing the Republican Party, to the extent it exists, can muster the courage to say, Madigan bad. They are the opposite side of the coin of all of the dum-dums of the left whose only argument against Trump was Orange Man bad. That was their sum total of political thought. Orange Man bad. Doesn't matter what he does. Here, Mike Madigan bad. That's the sole source of all our problems. That's the only thing that we can say. Okay. So, again, put this out to people. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Mike Madigan, ultimately gone. You know, Scott Faywell, if you remember when he got indicted, oh, yeah. George Ryan's former chief of staff, he got indicted about a year before George Ryan got indicted. So they're working their way up the food chain. And it may be a bit yet before they ultimately get Mike Madigan. Maybe it'll be 6 months. Maybe it'll be a year if indeed they do get him. But they're definitely getting closer. And then so what happens after that is the question. How does it usher in a new era? Or is it just finally not even a pound of flesh, like a half a pound of flesh, and they're like, oh, at least they got Madigan, so now Illinois is great.
Far from it.
George and Moni.
Hey, Dan, how about Lisa Madigan?
How about
her? She collected a salary for how many years? Didn't vision any of this stuff, didn't see anything. Yet I bet she's still getting a pension, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't she?
And so? What's wrong with that?
Well, I don't know. Just because a certain time has passed, now the crimes are forgotten. Of course, that's probably what's going to happen with Trump and all this other, the FBI and everything, but, you know.
Well, she was never asked to investigate her father.
I'm sorry, the Attorney General needs to be asked to investigate somebody? Is that how it works? Did somebody ask the U.S. Attorney to investigate ComEd and Mike Madigan? No. No, I don't think you have to be asked. I think you're a proactive law enforcement officer, so you initiate investigations if you have an interest in combating things like public corruption. Lisa Madigan didn't have an interest.
No.
Well, you know, she had other things on her mind.
Would have made it hard at Thanksgiving time, Dan. Like, hey, Dad, I got to discuss something with you.
I understand.
This
is
federal level.
Look, I don't want to make Thanksgiving dinner uncomfortable for the Madigans any more than I do for the Pritzkers. That is the highest priority.
He and his son this year.
By the way, at a related note, 2019, top inbound and top outbound U.S. states. Top outbound U.S. state? According to this measurement, I dispute it. But
New York?
New York is number one.
Okay.
Illinois is number two.
Think we should be number one, Dan?
I do. I dispute this. But, you know, number two is not bad. Inbound states, this is sort of interesting. Florida is fourth, South Carolina third.
Ooh, can I guess?
Uh-huh.
Tennessee.
Tennessee is
second, and Texas is one.
No, you're wrong. One,
Utah?
Two, three, four, five. Six. Mm. Tennessee is sixth. Texas is seventh. Utah is not on the grid.
Gosh,
not in the top 10.
That's fine. Don't tell anybody about that hidden secret.
The top five in reverse order. Five. Number five.
Yes.
Nevada. Number four, Florida. Number three, South Carolina. Number two, Idaho.
Oh, Idaho.
So I'll go to Sun Valley. And number one, Arizona.
Oh, really?
Well, that's going to change with that that income tax jack they just passed on November 3rd. But those are the top five inbound states. The top five outbound states?
So New York.
California, number five. Louisiana, number four. New Jersey, number three. Illinois, number two. New York, number one. Hmm. It's interesting when you look at some of the data, the way that Mark Perry crunched them over at the Carpe Diem blog. The average inbound versus the average outbound states, the top 10 outbound states, the top 10 inbound states. Nine of the 10 inbound states are right to work. State and local tax burden as a percentage of income is 9.53% in the average outbound, 7.83%, two percentage points or you know, about 20% less in the inbound states. The top state individual tax rate, outbound 7, inbound 3.5. The Forbes best states for business rankings, average outbound ranks at 36, average inbound 11. Imagine that. People go where the benefits are better, the opportunities more. This is interesting, too. The GDP growth rate is about 50% higher in the inbound states. Unemployment rate is about a third lower. Employment growth in 2019 in the inbound states, three times what it was in the outbound states. Well, right, sure. But people are moving, you're growing. Yeah, absolutely. So that's it. That's where Illinois finds itself after 50 years of bipartisan combine rule that will continue. Rich on the south side. Excuse me, Ron on the south side. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan. And Dan, I agree with you 100%. You know, Blago went to prison, and I mean,
this changed everything.
Corrupting, but yeah. Exactly. But you know what? Because Mike Madigan is a corrupt, lying scumbag, then I want him to go to prison. Look for it, and they need to put Ed Burke in prison also. You all have a good day.
Thanks, Ron. I agree. I mean, if I wasn't such a proponent of the rule of law and due process, I'd say put all 177 legislators in jail and, you know, just restart. I know we're going to get some innocent people in there, but, you know, who's really innocent in Springfield? Larry and Bartlett.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Just a rhetorical comment. You started the section, you made a comment about, I forget his name now, the leader of the Republican Party here is a super minority. I thought the better adjective would be stupid minority.
Mm-hmm.
But my comment is, I don't care if they put Madigan in jail or not, because if he goes to jail, there's 6,281 more people lined up right behind him to become the next super criminal. And on and on and on.
Thanks for the call, Larry. Don and McHenry.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Dan, I'm just curious with the inbound and outbound states. My presumption is a lot of the people leaving are Republicans, but have you seen any data as to what the political parties and how much it's changing the states, for example, if enough, you know, I don't think it's possible, but if enough Democrats left the state of Illinois, it could change it slightly?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question, Don. Thanks for that. I haven't seen good stats on that, but I'd love to, because one of my suppositions actually is that the worse they make it, the better it gets for them. You've probably heard me say that before. Which is to say, I mean, who's leading the exodus from Illinois? You know, people with skin in the game, people that want a better quality of life at a lower price point. So people that, you know, can do grade school math, which is mostly center-right voters. I suspect what you have is a hollowing out of these states, because who's insulated from terrible public policy? The beneficiaries of transfer payments, and those are your core Democrat socialist voters. And the champagne socialists who have the money to be indifferent to things like tax increases and feel like it's, you know, sort of like white man's burden to support tax increases. Champagne people, you know, who live in places like River Forest and the North Shore. So, you know, my guess is the net is more center right voters leave, and thus the margin of error actually gets smaller for a center-right revolution in states like Illinois to change the political balance of power. But I would love to see stats. I don't know that anybody's done a deep dive on that, but it's a great question, because somebody should. Marty in Naperville.
Good morning. Great show as usual. Why would anybody be surprised in Illinois? A governor was elected that was born with a $3 billion bank account, never had a job in his life, destroyed his home so he couldn't pay taxes, and he's leading us. I don't know why anybody is surprised the way this state is run. It's just, you know, Madigan is just going to get away with it. What is he? Does he own a tax? What is
property
he,
tax appeals?
So he sets tax codes and then he appeals them to big companies in Chicago.
Yeah, nobody's going to oppose this guy for fear of you know, their taxes going. I mean, you know, it's just. It is what it is. And unfortunately, it is what it is, man. I'm sorry.
Marty, thanks for the call. Here's something else to consider, too. John Lausch's tenure as U.S. attorney may be up in a Biden administration. And whoever Biden appoints would nominate for attorney general, you know, they're going to put their own U.S. attorneys in. So,
yeah, and here in the Northern District, too.
I'm not.
Fox might get that.
No chance. But I'm not certain that I'm not saying that, you know, because it's a Biden administration appointee, they'll just be in the tank for Madigan or Chicago Democrats. I'm not saying that. But it's sort
a
of
chance.
It sort of has happened before here, where U.S. attorneys sort of turned a blind eye to City Hall and to Springfield. So, you know, John Lausch may be on the clock, too, to make something happen with Madigan before January 20th.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Back in August, President Trump said, in recent months, our nation and the entire planet has been struck by a new and powerful invisible enemy. We are delivering life-saving therapies and will produce a vaccine before the end of the year, or maybe even sooner. Fact check by NBC News.
Yeah.
That's largely false. The president boasts of life-saving therapies, but critics argue there isn't enough evidence to back up this claim. There's also no evidence that an effective vaccine will be delivered by the end of the year. Yeah, they're so evidence-based in the D.C. press corps.
Well, Alex Azar put that to rest yesterday with good news, you know, because Pfizer now has completed their trial, 95% effective, and we will have vaccines by the end of December.
By the end of December, we expect to have about 40 million doses of these two vaccines available for distribution, pending FDA authorization, enough to vaccinate about 20 million of our most vulnerable.
That's great, and that should be celebrated. So guess what? President Trump was right.
There's also good news out of the UK. AstraZeneca Oxford team, their vaccine reportedly showing strong immune response in all ages. 13,000 people are taking part in the trial of the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine. 60,000 people around the world are trialing it. And the British government signed a deal with AstraZeneca and Oxford to buy 100 million doses if the vaccine is successful. And so it seems to be more good news on the vaccine front, in addition to Pfizer, in addition to Moderna, which both came in at 95% effective. So now we just need to continue to press on FDA when they move for approval to not let this get hung up in too much bureaucracy and move this along. And then that gets to all sorts of other questions in terms of the rank order prioritization of distribution and the actual logistics of distribution. For more on all of these matters, we're pleased to be joined by Dr. Terence Keeley, professor in clinical biochemistry at the University of Buckingham in the UK, and he's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Dr. Keeley, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So your reaction to where we are with these partnerships, AstraZeneca, Oxford, and Pfizer and BioNTech and Moderna, what we're getting in terms of the performance in clinical trials and, you know, the expectation that vaccines from one or more of these enterprises could be in the supply chains by the end of the year.
Well, this is very, very good news and very, very impressive. Normally, vaccines take years to get developed for the market. And the speed with which these companies have developed these vaccines is extraordinary. But I would also want to make a further point that this is a tremendous tribute to the free market, because particularly the first two companies that produced one, Pfizer's and their partners, BioNTech in Germany, they both produced their vaccines without taking money from the federal government, either in America or in Germany. And they did that because they believed that by investing their own money, they would maximize their own incentives and the market would work. And for those of us who believe in markets, the success of Pfizer's and BioNTech has been remarkable.
You must be very lonely in the field of biochemistry as someone who believes in markets.
Oh, I think I'm the only biochemist in the world who believes in markets.
And so it's an honor to have you. We found him. Yay! We finally found him. It is remarkable. And it's also, too, I mean, I remember, Dr. Keeley, you may have this sort of long-term memory as well, when big pharma companies were the bete noire of our existence in the West. I guess not so much anymore.
Well, no, not so much. In fact, today, of course, we all love big pharma, but of course, the time will come when we'll all hate them again. But the problem with big pharma, there is a genuine problem.
Oh, no question.
The problem is patents. Pharma demands, rightly so, by the way, pharma is right about this. They must have patents or they can't do their research and development, because obviously it costs something like $1 billion to bring a new drug to market, but it can only cost $10 or $20 million, i.e. a tiny fraction to copy. So they must have intellectual property. But on the other hand, the temptation to exploit that intellectual property can sometimes overcome biotech and big pharma. So it'll always be a love-hate relationship.
Another testament to the market comes to us from Lucira Health. They developed the first home COVID test that was approved by the FDA, that was approved yesterday, emergency green light to the first rapid coronavirus test that can run from start to finish at home. Simple nasal swab costs $50 or less, according to the product's website. So something else to enhance the facility and the expense of testing.
Yep. No one should be in any doubt that the only way to get new drugs and new proceeds like this is a free market. I mean, the idea that the Soviet Union or China would ever have produced a new drug is absurd. It is the free market that generates almost every advance that we have in pharmacology and in medical instrumentation. However, as I keep on having to say, the market itself can be abusive, and so there has to be some sort of relationship between the two. But we start with the premise that it's the free market that produces the goodies, and then we have to regulate it. It's that way round.
Could you walk us through the Moderna vaccination trial, how many volunteers, and the Pfizer one, too, and how it worked?
Yeah, the Moderna vaccination trial, I can absolutely give you that. And the Pfizer's one, so here, I got it actually right in front of me here. So Moderna had 30,000 volunteers. They gave half of them the vaccine and half only a placebo. And then they basically just let them out into the world. And then they came back to see who had got the disease a few weeks later. And as you said in your own introduction, 95% of those who got the disease, and there were a total of 94 of them, as it happens, were in the group on the placebo, i.e. they were not protected. A very similar story with Pfizer, 44,000 volunteers let out back into the white world. And a few weeks later, most of those who got the disease were in the placebo group and not the vaccine group.
Let's talk about the rank order priority for the vaccine in terms of distribution. Most people are suggesting, including National Academy of Sciences here, that it should be the most vulnerable and like frontline healthcare workers should be first. So people in nursing homes, people with comorbidities combined with frontline healthcare workers. However, a group of researchers at Johns Hopkins and USC, however, are arguing for vaccinating the young first. They have the least to fear from COVID, suffer the most under social restrictions, and it would do more to curb the spread and ultimately prevent more deaths. Do you find one more persuasive than the other in terms of approach?
Well, of course, we all have to feel sorry for the young. I think the young have really suffered under this, under the lockdowns, particularly in Europe. I think our lockdowns in Europe may be more rigorous, rightly or wrongly. I'm not necessarily defending that, than yours. And I think the young have felt it very badly because the young are a particular social group. I think the honest answer to your question is that this is not a question that can be answered by any particular expert. This is a question that can really only be answered by a democratic assembly. It's for everyone, because you don't need specialized knowledge to answer this question.
Right.
This is a question that only a democracy can answer. However, I would say that the speed by which these vaccines are being produced means, and there are enough companies out there, that we shouldn't actually have to ration them for more than 2 or 3 weeks. We should really be in a position where the government, on behalf of us all, would make the decision as to whom they're going to prioritize. And I would hope that would be taken by a discussion with the House and the Senate, so this is a genuinely democratic decision. That's how it would be done in the parliamentary system. However, there would be no reason, it seems to me, why in parallel a private market should not also develop, so that those who felt that they were unfairly biased against could then in any case do it privately as well. So basically all constituencies should be solved very quickly.
There was another study on masks that was published this week. This from Danish researchers. They had about 3,030 participants randomly assigned to the recommendation to wear masks, 2,994 assigned to the control group. 4,800 people completed the study, and the upshot was 1.8% of mask wearers and 2.1% non-mask wearers were infected with COVID-19. The 95% confidence interval is compatible with a 46% reduction to a 23% increase in infection. So the upshot is either modest or no benefit to mask wearing from this study, which comports with another study recently completed and published by the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in conjunction with the U.S. Navy, with the Marines as the volunteer subjects, both in the control and the experimental group. So what are we to understand about mask wearing as it's being advertised as a panacea in the West?
Well, hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Yep.
Hello, can you hear us?
Yeah. Your question is very, very pertinent. Mask wearing has become a form of signaling of your desire to be associated with all the right side of this debate. And my feeling would be that that would probably be an appropriate signal to engage in until such time as the scientific evidence comes in. Thereupon, we should be determined solely by the scientific evidence. I am not aware personally of the very latest work on masks. So my position would be, but this is me as an individual, there is no specialized knowledge here. There can't be before the science comes out. But my position would be that it would be sensible to wear masks until such time as we know. But once we know, we should be driven by the science. I hate to use that cliche. We should be driven by the science and not by hunch. So it's another difficult situation because none of us wants to be guilty of virtue signaling. On the other hand, none of us wants to take gratuitous risks. And since mask wearing is not so intolerable, it would be reasonable to wear masks until the science is in. That would be my judgment, but that's just one man's judgment. There are 300 million people in America whose judgment is just as good as mine.
I'm not sure about that, but I don't know if it's as good as yours. But yes, your point is well taken. I wanted to get your reaction to something that Holman Jenkins wrote in the Wall Street Journal about the incomprehensible mistake we never would have made with the flu, as he wrote, confusing confirmed cases with true prevalence. The worst effect, he writes, about this obsession with confirmed cases, with obsession by the media and thus obsession by the public, is it causes Americans to both overestimate the death risk from COVID, but even worse, causes them to underestimate by an order of magnitude the likelihood that the person next to them is a transmitter. How do you react to that, that assessment of confusing confirmed cases with true prevalence in society?
He's 100% right. He couldn't be more right. There's no way we're testing, particularly in the early stages of the disease, there was absolutely no way we were testing anything. I mean, whole orders of magnitude we weren't testing. I would like to say, however, and I'm not trying to make a partisan point, I'm just telling you how it is. Mm-hmm. There were countries such as South Korea and Taiwan and other Far Eastern countries who really were testing unbelievably swiftly right at the very beginning of the pandemic. And their data is much more reliable because they really were on top of it. But you're absolutely right. In Europe or the United States, the data on positive testing is only a reflection of testing. It's not a reflection of the disease. They're completely different factors. And everything that he said in the Wall Street Journal is correct.
Dr. Terence Keeley, professor in clinical biochemistry at the University of Buckingham in the UK. He's also an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. Dr. Keeley, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I want to go back to John Oliver because it's just so fun. John Oliver is, again, one of these insufferable hosts that was given a show on HBO, much like Bill Maher. His show is called Last Week Tonight. Not that I'm recommending it. He's supposed to be funny, allegedly. Sort of a daily show with a bit of a sharper edge. I mean, it went back when the Daily Show was a thing, you know what I mean? And John Oliver's a contributor, ironically. Last year, very concerned, as the left was, about Russian hacking into our elections, Russian interference, he did a bit of a dive on the integrity of the actual voting machines in this country. It was actually a decent piece. He spent about 20 minutes going into the particulars, providing some information that is verifiable, that's accurate, raising concerns about the vulnerability of these machines to manipulation, to hacking. He's focused on Putin, but obviously, and Russians, but it could be anybody with ill motives, couldn't it?
As you'll see tonight, leaving our voting machines in the middle of Moscow, or indeed the middle of America, might not be the best idea, because a Senate report found that some of our voting equipment is aging and vulnerable to exploitation by a committed adversary. So tonight, let's talk about our voting machines. And first, you should know, there is no single standard voting system in this country. In some places, you vote by filling out a paper ballot and feeding it into a machine. At others, you press a button, get a printout, and then have that scanned into a different machine. And at still others, you press a touchscreen, and that's it. That's the whole voting process. And while that last option may seem like the best, it's actually, for reasons that we'll get into later, the absolute worst. There's also the threat of someone gaining control of them for their own ends, because voting machines are technically computers, and computers, of course, are hackable. And it can be far easier to control a machine than you might expect. Voting machine companies and election officials will tell you that hacks like that one take place in very controlled settings, and that it would be difficult to do that in an actual booth without people noticing. But it is not always as difficult to get some alone time with a machine as you might think.
Professor Ed Felton of Princeton performs an exercise every election day. He drives around Princeton to various polling locations, and he follows the prominent signs that say, voting here, days before the election, and then he takes photographs of unattended voting machines just sitting there. And that's for him to document that anybody can walk up to these voting machines, and anybody can manipulate them, and nobody will know.
So to recap, I've now shown you how to hack voting machines in less than 2 minutes, and how to find unattended voting machines.
Mm-hmm. And he raised the issue, particularly with the paperless direct reporting electronic voting machines, the DREs, that don't leave a paper trail, paperless, no paper trail. And he had this to say about what, and remember, this is somebody, a man of the hard left who despises Trump, wants him to concede right now, doesn't want him even pursuing the claims of fraud or election irregularities, violations of the Constitution pending in courts around the country. This is what he said in his 2019 report addressing concerns about voter fraud with respect to the digital machines, with respect to the voting infrastructure generally.
The problem is, it's endless. The latest claim is that voting machines or software change votes, even though this government cybersecurity agency created...
It's not surprising.
Sorry, that wasn't it. Hold on 1 second. There we go.
Because what we have to do here is obvious. It's so obvious, in fact. Even this guy understands it.
One of the things we're learning is it's always good. It's old-fashioned, but it's always good to have a paper backup system of voting. It's called paper, not highly complex computers, paper. And a lot of states are doing that.
Yeah. He's right. That's it. He's just all the way completely right.
Completely right, but he shouldn't prosecute cases now that raise these issues that John Oliver raised last year because it wasn't Putin. Interesting. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Kenneth Timmerman, nationally recognized investigative reporter and war correspondent who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. He's the author of, as far as I'm concerned, the definitive biography on Jesse Jackson Sr. called Shakedown. If you haven't read that, and all of Jesse Jackson Sr.'s skullduggery and race hustling and poverty pimping, then I encourage you to read Shakedown. His most recent book is a political thriller, fiction, called The Election Heist, but it's a fiction that seems to mirror reality. Ken Timmerman, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning, Dan. Good to be with you, Amy. Thank you.
And so the issues raised not by Sidney Powell or the Trump campaign legal team, how about John Oliver, you know, court jester on HBO last year that are being actually lit. Speaking of life living up to the fulfillment of concerns that were being addressed by John Oliver last year.
You know, I was pretty stunned to listen to those clips that you just played, because that coincides with all of the research that I did for the election heist. I looked into the security of our electronic voting machines, and I got to say, John, he had it exactly right. The machines are vulnerable. As one cybersecurity expert in the U.S. government told me as I was, again, researching the election heist, if it is controlled by software, it can be hacked, it being a voting machine or anything else. And, you know, votes can be switched by changing the software that counts the votes. That is the plot in my book. And it looks like that may have happened in some places in the real world.
Were you able to find out why we still even use electronic voting machines?
Well, remember, this is all, they are supposed to be an upgrade from what we had in Florida in 2000.
Right.
After the hanging chads in Florida, Congress passed several laws, but one of them required states to upgrade their voting systems and gave them money to do so. So these machines are supposed to be the upgrade. And again, as John Oliver said, most of them, not all, but most of them do have some form of paper ballot. I am most concerned about the paper ballots in Georgia because they are actually machine generated. They're created by a ballot marking device made by Dominion voting systems. And if voters don't actually examine the paper ballot that the machine spits out before they put it into the scanner, they could have voted for Trump. They could have voted for Biden, and the ballot says the opposite. Or, you know, they have no guarantee unless they actually verify their ballot, and not everybody does.
And with respect to your novel, did you come up with vendors for both the hardware as well as the software that were as fantastical as the actual vendors in America?
Well, you know, it's funny. I call the vendor Dominant Technologies in the book, and the book went on sale in August, okay, 3 months before the election. It was finished in February of 2020, so well before this election took part. And there's a scene in the book that's hilarious where one of the characters is talking about the man who owns Dominant Technologies. He's called Richard Foreman Hall, and he's a billionaire hedge fund owner, extreme left-winger, who pledges to spend $100 million this year to defeat Donald Trump. And, of course, there's nobody like that who
owns
Dominion voting systems.
Yeah.
But we did learn that a gentleman named Mark Mollick Brown, who is a member of the House of Lords in Britain, was the primary investment partner of George Soros, and he was the chairman of the board of Smartmatic, the one that helped develop the software used in all those Dominion systems.
Yeah, in conjunction with the Chavez regime in Venezuela.
That's right. And by the way, what I have found, well, it would be amusing if it weren't so serious. Dominion has been backpedaling big time in recent days. They're putting out all these, fact-checking papers and saying, no, we don't have foreign money, and no, we don't have servers in Germany, and no, we're not tied to Chavez and all this stuff. Well, they forgot to mention that, yes, their main headquarters is actually up in Toronto on the third floor of a building right next door to the Tides Foundation, a George Soros organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just a coincidence, though, right?
Just a coincidence, comrade. Just a coincidence.
and the other thing too is they're disputing things that one would think are relatively easily provable or disprovable, which is that there's a business relationship between Dominion voting systems and Smartmatic. And Sidney Powell has documented this. One of the leads on Trump's legal team, but. And there's reporting on this too from the foreign press that Dominion and Smartmatic were sort of, kissing cousins in a business sense.
Right. Well, Dominion, yes, they all go back to a company called Sequoia Voting Systems,
oh, yes.
And they were involved in the buyout of Sequoia and involved in co-developing software. So to say that they don't have a relationship is pathetic. It's ridiculous. It is not true. And it shows how vulnerable Dominion feels themselves to be right now. They've got hundreds of millions of dollars on the line. And I think, quite understandably, they're trying to protect their business model, which I think Americans are beginning to question quite seriously.
It seems like the Trump campaign, from some of the pronouncements from both Powell and campaign surrogates, are asserting at this point, and it's an assertion, they have to prove it, of course, that where vote tabulation was manipulated was when the information, the data, was uploaded to the cloud-based servers in Germany and Spain. It was at that point that the manipulation occurred, that the changing of the tabulations occurred. What's your sense of the election infrastructure going from the hardware and the software to these cloud-based servers in Europe?
Well, I tend to doubt that that is what happened. And I'll tell you why I tend to doubt that, because it would be easy, frankly, to discover. If there's a discrepancy between the vote tallies at the precinct level and at the county level, where the information would come back from the cloud, you would discover it the next morning when the USB drives are brought in. And again, that's a process I describe in the election heist in quite some detail. They actually have to bring in these physical drives, and the drives
right.
have the counts taken from the machines on election night. And it's a backup. It is a added security to make sure that the vote tally is not hacked in transit as it's being, sent around the world electronically. So they could actually figure that out pretty quickly. I tend to think, and that's the scenario in the election heist, that the machines themselves were hacked when they updated the software. And the software has to be certified by Republicans and Democrats. They do a zero run on the machines to make sure everything's calibrated properly, that it's counting properly. And they do this weeks ahead of the election. We're learning now in many Georgia counties that they were updated on October 31st.
Right.
Dominion.
Yeah. And that was a source of an operator error in allegedly in both Michigan and as well as Georgia.
Well, the ones in Michigan was up. Apparently it was changed the day of. But Dominion is actually acknowledging they uploaded new software on October 31st as if that was the most normal thing in the world. It is not. It is absolutely not the most normal thing in the world. As I say, those machines have to be certified weeks ahead of voting with representatives of both parties present, and apparently they were not. So that's where I think the hack occurred. If there was a hack, it was when the software was changed.
I don't want you to spoil your novel by giving us how it shakes out, but just tell me, because since your novel is art preceding life,
yeah, just political thriller that feels so real.
Just tell us that it doesn't end with Nancy Pelosi as the president of the United States. Just please tell us that
it does not. It does not end with Nancy Pelosi as president of the United States. But
okay.
I try to have a somewhat happy ending because I rely on characters, supervisors of elections, who are honest and who are inquisitive and look at discrepancies in the vote, and they start pulling the threads and investigating to see what actually happened. And ultimately, they do discover that the machines were hacked, but they can't prove it in all the states that it happened. It's only in one state, but luckily that actually keeps President Trump in power. I'm afraid that in real life, that may not be the case. We have not yet discovered enough of these vote flips to change the outcome in any of the states. So I'm a little worried.
Yeah, I would be as well. I am, and it would be as well. Ken Timmerman, nationally recognized investigative reporter, war correspondent, was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, author of Shakedown about Jesse Jackson Sr., which I recommend, and his political thriller just out this fall, which we were discussing, is called The Election Heist, which you can get at all the usual places. Ken Timmerman, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great pleasure.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and David Atkins is an elected member of the Democrat National Committee. He's a contributor to left-wing outlets like Prospect and Washington Monthly. He asks on Twitter, no, seriously, how do you deprogram 75 million people? Where do you start? Fox? Facebook? We have to start thinking in terms of post-World War II Germany or Japan or the failures of Reconstruction in the South. Boy, a big plans the left has for Trump voters, just in case you thought that prospective Biden administration was going to deliver on that unity that Joe Biden prattled on about during the campaign.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Barrett also signaling a kinder, gentler era, more responsible era with the prospect of a Biden administration. Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee, reacting to the Trump campaign pursuing their legal options, which offends the left, I understand, and paying for a recount in Milwaukee and Dane counties, doing that yesterday. Here was the mayor of Milwaukee, Tom Barrett, reacting.
It's not surprising. After a failed presidency, after a failed campaign, that the Trump campaign would now seek to have a what will soon be failed recount effort. In fact, it's a very futile attempt to try to disrupt democracy in the most democratic counties in the state of Wisconsin. But that should be no surprise to anyone, because after 4 years of racial attacks, after 4 years of attacks on cities, after 4 years of attempting to divide people, why wouldn't President Trump end his presidency on one last failed attempt to divide us?
Let's get reaction from our friend Hogan Gidley. He is the national press secretary for the Trump campaign. Hogan, it's nice that we have put the Trump era divisiveness behind us, isn't it? Oh, we don't have Hogan yet? Oh. Okay.
Well, I think it's strange that the mayor of Milwaukee calls Trump campaign a failed campaign when Biden didn't even go out and campaign.
All right. I think we have Hogan now. Hogan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. I appreciate the time. Thanks for having me.
The divisiveness of the Trump era now over, according as you can see here from Tom Barrett and David Atkins, DNC board member, air of good feelings, 21st century.
Yeah. You saw him here in D.C. this past weekend. The Trump folks, you know, came to town. Now, granted, I hadn't seen that much Make America Great Again spandex in my life, but it was a good group walking through the city streets, and they were all excited and peacefully assembling and enjoying Washington, D.C. And then night fell, and Antifa and BLM and Defund the Police came out, and then so much peace and so much unity ensued that they had to bring a lot of, you know, cops in. They had to break up a lot of, you know, fights, and if a person got stabbed. So it's all that peace and unity they were talking about before. And it was my understanding, you know, if that's how they act after they won, can you imagine what had happened if that night, you know, the lead that Donald Trump held was still in place?
I know.
Everything is still be burning to the ground.
You can understand, though, their confusion, the BLMers and the Antifa-ers, because they thought that the police had been defunded in D.C. So you can understand why they were surprised when they showed up.
Well, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, you know, because it's what I think it was AOC who said, how is it going to look when you defund the police like the suburbs? And that to me, when people are outside eating and then getting physically abused and attacked and then, you know, fireworks thrown at them, that's exactly like every suburb I've been in. I don't know where you hang out, but to me, that seems pretty reasonable and rational and, as I said, peaceful and yeah, you know, unifying.
Well,
like that works.
I always tell the kids, you know, they didn't board up downtown Chicago for Republicans. They did it. Honestly,
that.
I tweeted that
and got roasted for it. I said, make no mistake, they're boarding up all of D.C. They're not doing it for Trump supporters. I'm sorry, they're just not. I mean, we have hundreds of thousands of people descend onto this city every year for conservative causes, whether it be March for Life or the return down here. They didn't board up the city for that because they know Republicans don't act that way. And Joe Biden can't call out BLM by name. He can't call out defund the police by name. He can't call out Antifa by name, and he won't, because they're all his supporters. And it's pretty obvious. They're not walking around with MAGA hats smashing in storefronts and burning down churches and looting and rioting and attacking innocent Americans in the streets with MAGA flags. They're just not. Enough of this.
But even after election night, Antifa smashed into the Portland, Oregon Biden-Harris campaign office. I mean, nothing will satisfy them.
No, and look, you know, there are a lot of old adages about that, but the alligator is going to turn on you sooner or later. I mean, you know, you can satiate the alligator and feed it enough, but sooner or later it's going to turn on you, and that's probably what's going to happen. But honestly, though, what did you think the result was going to be when you had people like Maxine Waters saying, "Find people from the administration, get in their faces, let them know they're not welcome here, cause a scene." You had Eric Holder say, when they go low, we kick them. What did you think was going to happen after Democrats have been saying this for years? And oftentimes, Democrats always accuse Republicans of things they themselves are guilty of doing. So Donald Trump colludes with Russia, but it was Democrats who had a Russian dossier with information from a British spy in there. Talk about colluding. It was Democrats who said, Donald Trump's trying to move the date of the election. It was actually the Democrats who sued in 18 states to allow votes to come in and be counted after Election Day. It was Democrats who said Republicans won't accept the results of the election. Hillary Clinton never accepted the results of the election and told Joe Biden never to concede in any form or fashion. And here's a great example that you just brought up, which is Democrats say Donald Trump incites violence. Our folks walk around peaceably all day long, not a problem, until it's Democrats and Joe Biden, his supporters, and the woke show up in town. That's when things devolve into lawlessness and criminality. They are always guilty of the things they accuse us of doing.
Yeah, like the registered Democrat in Florida arrested over the weekend for threatening to shoot Governor DeSantis and Senators Marco Rubio and Rick Scott in Florida. But yet we hear that we get the preening and the woe is me and the I'm being targeted, I'm being threatened, and it's the Trump voters or it's the divisiveness of the Trump era being visited upon a Gretchen Whitmer or a J.B. Pritzker, when unfortunately you have people that just are not adult and they can't handle disagreements without resorting to violence or threats. But that's a category of people that has nothing to – we don't attach it and blame Bernie Sanders for the guy who shot up the softball game in D.C. But they try to make the case all the time, as Whitmer has, as Pritzker has, that somehow it's Trump supporters that are engaged in threatening behavior or juvenile conduct.
Right, and that person literally did it in the name of Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
And we, as Republicans, still didn't say that's still not Bernie Sanders' fault because he's not right. Calling for those things directly. That's just logic. And then if someone actually has a hashtag MAGA in a tweet from 3 years ago, they say, oh, it's the president's fault. He's the one doing it. I'm just so sick and tired of it, and I'm so thankful that we had a president the last 4 years telling the American people, I'm not going to put up with it anymore. I'm not going to sit here and say and agree that, oh, yeah, there are some elements that are horribly racist and things like that. No, we're not racist. No one's racist in this party. We're focused on making sure all Americans succeed, and that's why this president's policies
were beneficial to everyone, regardless of race, religion, color, or creed. That's why African Americans saw an expanded wages for the first time in decades and high employment rates, the highest they'd ever seen, while Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, and women were all employed at record numbers. This president wants everyone to succeed. He believes that this country is the greatest idea ever realized. Democrats can't talk like that because they just don't believe it, and it's obvious every single day.
Well, let's get a status on the counts and the cases. The count, the recount will be published by Georgia election officials today. The Wisconsin recount in those two counties I mentioned at the outset, about to get underway. What is your anticipation with respect to those, the recount that's been completed and the recount that's forthcoming?
Well, we'll see. Look, it's pretty obvious they're finding votes for Donald Trump all over the place. Notice, though, that they weren't found at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m, and there weren't hundreds of thousands of them that were 100% for one candidate. They found a memory stick in two or three places, and those had votes for both candidates. It just so happens a majority of those votes were for the president. That's obviously problematic. Recounting is a good thing, but an audit is really important, because if you recount all fraudulent votes, or if you recount votes that were cast illegally, then that's obviously an issue. And let's separate the two. Fraud is when a dead person votes, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm well aware of the fact dead people in this election didn't just vote. They actually requested mail-in ballots, filled out mail-in ballots, and somehow got them to a post office or to a mailbox. Now, that might be the problem with polling, is that they're not polling dead people, because obviously they're a large constituency in this past election.
Right.
Those things are obvious fraud. But when you count illegally cast votes, 2.6 million of which are in Pennsylvania, where they did not signature verify those votes that came in the mail, that's a serious problem, and it needs to be addressed.
And so if the recount in Georgia is to Biden's benefit, he still ultimately is the victor on the initial recount. Are you guys going to litigate that and try to do that sort of audit that you're describing?
We think that's important, because the American people deserve a free and fair election, and they deserve to know that their election process is legitimate, that they can have confidence in it, they can have faith in it. And right now, with so many irregularities and so many illegitimate votes and so many inconsistencies, that's just not the case right now. And so we want to make sure that happens, regardless of how this turns out. Obviously, we need to make sure that that is the case going forward, whether it be for those Senate races coming up in Georgia, or we retroactively take a serious look at what's going on, the country that just in the election that just happened. I mean, it's very significant, because you have to have confidence that whoever ultimately ends up getting the most votes, that they got them in a way that's legitimate. Because we saw what happened in the last 4 years when they tried to blame Donald Trump's victory on Russia, which was a total hoax and a total lie. It sows some seeds of serious discontent, and it makes people, go crazy. We can't have that here, and that's one of the things we're trying to prevent moving forward.
Hogan, what about Pennsylvania? Do you know how many mail-in ballots were counted that were received after November 3rd? Because we heard anywhere from 350,000 to 600,000.
To 10,000.
I'm not sure how many were – I don't know how many were cast after Election Day. Obviously, that's against the law in Pennsylvania, because – the laws are set up in every state by the state legislatures. And when the Secretary of State, who's a Democrat and a Democrat-controlled Supreme Court, says, now we're going to blow past that law and count votes after Election Day, that's, we believe, unconstitutional. But I can tell you 2.6 million, as I mentioned before, were brought in by the mail that were not signature verified. There are 682,497 votes cast in where we did not have someone monitoring those votes. That also is against Pennsylvania law as well. So there are millions of votes out there to be reconsidered in the way they were cast. And so illegalities, fraud, all types of inconsistencies, we have to get to the bottom of it.
I want to get to the big claims that Sidney Powell has made, that other campaign surrogates, including Brian Trasher, have made. He made the other night on Newsmax, that you have the manipulation of the vote tabulation by either the software or hardware providers, the voting machine providers and software providers like Dominion and Smartmatic, or somebody exploiting those vulnerabilities in those systems. You know, the big question that everybody wants to know, you know, when is evidence that has been suggested the Trump campaign has going to be presented either in a court document or the court of public opinion?
Yeah, that's up to our attorneys. They're rifling through countless examples of you know, overvotes, of vote switches in machines and other things. And when they choose to actually, you know, present that, whether it be in a court of law or in the media, is kind of up to them. And I'm not an attorney, so I definitely don't want to get into
But I mean, I understand that. But I mean, you know, Sidney Powell, and I know she's a serious person. I know she's an accomplished appellate attorney and all of those things. And she's done a great job representing General Flynn through his saga. But I mean, she is staking her reputation on these claims. So the evidence has to be there. I'm you know, inclined to believe it is.
Yeah, no, look, I think we've seen a lot of evidence of machines malfunctioning and machines counting votes for Joe Biden that were actually cast for Donald Trump. We saw that in Michigan where the software switched all the votes, and we're taking a look at that because that software was also used in many other states around the country. But, you know, it's in a court of law, so you have to know what you can prove, right? And if we can have the information, we have the data, and that's what Rudy Giuliani and that's what Jenna Ellis and that's what Sidney Powell are doing, is combing through all that data and all that information, that when they have it and they have it airtight, my assumption is that they're going to release that to the American people, release that in a court of law, and people are going to see just how corrupt some of these places became in the last election. And if it's enough to change the outcome, then it's enough to change the outcome. Either way, we've got to know what happened.
And
right now we don't.
And I assume the campaign, I mean, Trump said, the president said a few days ago, you should have something, you know, something, be prepared to present something in a couple of weeks. I mean, that sort of indicates that the campaign is on that sort of December 8th, December 14th timeline to prove up or not, right?
Yeah. It looks like, I mean, there's some deadlines coming up that we have to make sure we meet before the electors are put in place and before they cast votes. Because, you know, you can't certify things, you can't send up electors if you don't truly know the outcome, if you don't truly know what happened without a shadow of a doubt. And that's what these court cases are all about. Look, Joe Biden took, you know, or excuse me, not Joe Biden, but Al Gore took a month and a half to get through his court cases. And for some reason, the big tech, big media and big corporations are saying, no, you're going to do it right now. You're going to agree that Joe Biden won. That's not how this works. We've got to make sure that these votes were cast legally and lawfully. And we want, you know, the American people, citizens of this country, who cast legal ballots to decide the outcome of the election, and not, you know, those big government entities that tell us this is how it's going to be.
He is Hogan Gidley, National Press Secretary for the Trump campaign. Hogan, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Are you ready for this?
What now? I don't know if I can handle it.
Nicholas Kristof, writing in the New York Times. Nicholas Kristof, man of the left. When Trump was right and many Democrats were wrong. What? Trump has been demanding for months that schools reopen, and in that he seems to have been largely right. Schools, especially elementary schools, do not appear to have been major sources of coronavirus transmission, and remote learning is proving to be a catastrophe for many low-income children. Yet America is shutting schools, as New York City just did yesterday again.
Which is stupid because the positivity rate in the school is 0.167.
Even as it allows businesses like restaurants and bars to operate, what are our priorities? It only took Nick Kristof about 8 months to come to that question, one we've been hotly debating from the outset of the lockdowns in the spring. But it is a momentous occasion when somebody from the New York Times says when Trump was right and many Democrats wrong, and that New York Times actually allows it to be published these days. The overwhelming evidence and consensus about in-person education, and yet the lockdowns continue. The remote learning persists. Maybe Nick Kristof will be the Pied Piper of elites in America. We'll see. For more on those elites in America, we're pleased to be joined by Lance Morrow, contributing editor of City Journal, the Henry Grunwald Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, essayist at Time for many years, and author of the soon-to-be-released God and Mammon, Chronicles of American Money. Lance, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Delighted to be there.
So you had this piece in City Journal about elite opinion and how it's never wrong. Nick Kristof is saying that an elitist himself, that it was wrong in the case of school closures. How do we square this?
I read that this morning and was amazed. The story of the New York Times and its intolerance for any dissenting opinions, and particularly in the James Bennett case, where it forced out the opinion editor simply because he allowed an op-ed by Senator Cotton to be published, didn't prepare me for Kristof this morning. That's really quite surprising, and I hope it means that they may be having second thoughts. Particularly, I mean, these are the people who put out the 1619.
Rewriting of American history. Well, they want the kids to get back in school so they can learn that the true founding of the nation was in 1619.
Yeah, right. I mean, the reason I wrote this column or what I was thinking about in this column was that for all of my rather long life, I have been aware of this phenomenon even way before I was born, and all during the 1930s. Winston Churchill, for example, in Britain was regarded as a crackpot and an extremist. By the elites and the fashionable opinion makers and so on. When I was a kid, Dwight Eisenhower, who was only the guy who ran the biggest military operation in the history of the world to invade Europe and defeat the Third Reich, was regarded condescendingly as something of a, not exactly an idiot, but a dullard, and a man who played golf and read Zane Grey westerns. And then years later, when I was writing for Time magazine during the Reagan administration, Reagan himself was regarded, the universal opinion on the left and among these fashionable people was that he was an idiot.
Amiable dunce, to quote Clark Clifford,
amiable dunce, and he was no such. I mean, my father knew him, and plenty of people, you know, who I knew him, and knew perfectly well that he was no such thing, not even close. That he was, what interests me is the way that people talk, and particularly people on the left, who come out of the academy and work in the media and so on, the way that they talk themselves into these narratives and they persuade themselves. The latest truly egregious example is defund the police. It's amazing to me that they keep churning out these narratives. They project these narratives, which often prove to be not only false, but disastrously false in the formation of policy. and responses to problems.
And Lance, another one that's popping up is, you know, President Trump's not conceding, so he's threatening our democracy.
Yeah. I mean, it gets to be. I think that in the age we live in, which is the age one can't say enough of smartphones and 24/7 agitations in media and so on. In this age, when the fake and the true are all coming at you on the screens 24/7, it becomes really alarming to have these to realize that public discourse is so saturated with these vivid false narratives, and of course, the left is not the only one, the only people who do it, but it is particularly vivid on the left.
You write in your piece, if you toss ignorance and arrogance and snobbery into a blender, you're going to get a poisonous concoction. And you suggest that after witnessing a vote of now 75 million Americans for Trump and a few more for Biden, everyone would wish to proceed with patience and care, and above all, with that virtue now all but extinct in American politics, humility. It was interesting you chose that word because it called to mind what Whitaker Chambers said in Witness: there can be no true humility and no true compassion where there is no courage. And it seems to me that we need to take one step back. We are a nation of cowards in so many ways, and cowards are incapable of humility or compassion.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked that Whitaker Chambers quote, because Chambers was an interesting case of going against the, I don't know if your listeners beyond a certain age or younger than a certain age, I'm sure they don't know anything about the Whitaker Chambers Alger his case, but that was another example of fashionable opinion siding entirely with Alger Hiss, whereas the truth was the reverse, that Alger Hiss was in fact the communist agent that Whitaker Chambers said he was. And that's a great quote about humility. I think that courage and humility are exactly the point here. And something has gotten really turned upside down in this country in terms of our sense of virtue, our sense of how the relationship of the individual to the country is. And identity politics, for example, is a really perverse, sets up a perverse relationship between the individual and the country, and it's a very uncivilized relationship. Identity politics is not good for the country. It's very bad for the country, I'm sorry to see the country in the grip of this stuff, and I don't know whether you can see the way out, but it's very discouraging. Of course, this is an abnormally tumultuous kind of year, and so it's difficult to get people to calm down and start thinking about things like humility. But
he is Lance Morrow, contributing editor of City Journal, the Henry Grunwald Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and an essayist at Time for many years. His soon-to-be-released new book, God and Mammon, Chronicles of American Money. Lance Morrow, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Delighted. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Speaking of men, this is news you can use.
What?
Interesting look-see at how penis size determines your salary.
Okay, you know what?
You know what? Is this thing on? I'm gonna step out now and have you guys have this conversation.
You're not interested in this?
I'm glad that our HR director, Debbie Litwin, just came in and brought us breakfast. She can listen to this conversation along with me.
You have two boys.
I know.
They have penises. They do.
But I don't.
Don't you care about how much they're going to make when they grow up?
I don't care to know.
On buy.com, survey 997 men to answer questions about work, salary, and penis size.
I mean, do you guys get out measuring tapes? What is this? All right, no, do continue.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. They found those with a penis of 3 inches in length earned an average of 58,000 pounds per year. However, at the end of the scale, those with a penis size that measured 7 or 8 inches earned an average of 38,000 and 27,000 pounds per year. Less than half in the case of 8 inches.
Wow.
Unless you're Hunter Biden. Hi-oh. It's also by industry. It's interesting.
Industry.
So size does matter, but not in the way you think.
Exactly. Huh? You know what? I have to tell you that's pretty surprising what you just shared with our viewers.
Is it?
What about by industry? I'm actually writing this down just in case.
Manual laborers had the highest proportion of 6 and 7 inch penises. Mm-hmm. Manual laborers. Uh-huh. Highest proportion of 3 inch penises.
Uh-huh. The tech company.
Baking and finance.
What?
Baking and finance.
Baking.
Banking. And finance.
All right, banking and finance. All right. Well, all right.
They're always overcompensating in those sectors. You see it. Wolf of Wall Street. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah.
That has to be less for banking and finance. That was too springy. Yeah.
What about radio personality?
The second, we'll get to that.
Oh no.
Yeah.
They did a thing for members of the media.
The second shortest, if you will, I guess. Lawyers, banking and finance, average 3 inch penises, followed by lawyers had the highest percentage of 3 inchers. Lawyers were the next highest percentage of 3 inchers.
Yeah. That's really good.
Maybe the ladies are interested in this too. But I mean, in terms of being a provider, right? The kind of paychecks you're bringing home.
Right.
And the kind of payload you're carrying, if you know what I mean. Radio talk show hosts, not.
What? No, no. I want to know.
They were not.
The members of the media?
Included.
Oh, they weren't included in the survey?
In the drill down, if you will.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me see.
What about teacher? Like, did it go?
I guess we'd be considered the arts.
Mm. Well, what does it have for the arts?
The arts, 53% of those in the artistic community. Well, let me do it this way. 69% of those in the artistic community had penises of 6 inches or greater.
Okay.
So, I guess I'm sort of an outlier in the combination of salary and size.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Morning, Dan and Amy. A good piece by Andra Mikta at Politico. He's the dean of the College of International and Security Studies at the George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies. Talking about China. He made this important observation, which really deserves more development, about what China is doing to try to make a play to supplant America as the world superpower.
To take down our country.
Aligning with Russia, offering economic inducements to countries in Europe and Asia to consider breaking ranks with Washington. Obviously, what they've done is they've insinuated themselves in America that was being undone by the Trump administration, things like their Confucius Institutes and the like. But he writes something else. What Beijing is offering is a deceptively compelling vision of the world, a free market for unfree people. A free market for unfree people. in which prosperity and individual freedom are no longer need to be inextricably intertwined. We give you prosperity in exchange for freedom. Protection and prosperity in exchange for freedom. That is an old Marxist canard. This is the historical materialism that defined Karl Marx's philosophy. But it's been repackaged and represented, and in an era of COVID, it's, enjoying renewed popularity, it would seem, at least in many urban centers and suburban, they're attached to suburban areas around the country. COVID fear, opening up the prospect of free market for unfree people, not just in Beijing. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by G. Patrick Lynch. He's a senior fellow at the Liberty Fund. Pat Lynch, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, thank you for having me.
Declaration of Independence from COVID Fear is your piece at lawliberty.org. I know you reference in your piece, you go through it in some detail, the great Barrington Declaration, which we've spoken about a lot on this show, that has, you know, tens of thousands of signatories from medical health professionals to regular old Joes like me. To talk more globally and include the Great Barrington Declaration, if you'd like, talk more globally about COVID fear and the implications. Am I overstating the case when I raise the prospect of Beijing is offering?
Well, I don't know that you're overstating the case with regards to some of the alternatives that are out there and some of the alternatives in the way they would affect the political, social, and economic order in the West. The piece that I wrote referenced the Great Barrington Declaration as a way to try to start a policy discussion. My concern, apropos of your reference to China, is that the policies that are being crafted right now with regards to COVID are not subject to public policy discussion. We, the governed, are no longer part of the discussion. We are not allowed to present alternatives. We're not allowed to talk about the trade-offs that our current policies are forcing us to accept. We're not allowed to discuss alternatives, and we're not allowed to do those things when we know a heck of a lot more about the virus. We know a heck of a lot more about treating it, and we know what the consequences and the costs are. And I try to outline some of those trade-offs and some of those costs, not just tangible, but also theoretical and philosophical in my piece.
And so talk about some of the trade-offs that we're not properly discussing. We tried to talk about them here, but your perspective on the trade-offs before us, because they don't seem to be obvious to many millions of Americans who think that they can select certain options without consequence.
Well, I think it references back to your previous discussion regarding elite opinion, that elites have been accepted without any thought about the effects that it has on hundreds of millions of other Americans. So there are health costs, and as I referenced in the piece, heart attack death rates have doubled. There are practical costs with regards to cancer screenings that are being foregone. There are practical costs with regards to educational years lost. There are practical costs for mental health. There are practical costs for friendship and everyday life. The idea that Thanksgiving is now nothing but a threat to your health rather than an opportunity to share friendship and time with family, or even the basic idea that governance is a collaborative effort between those who are governed and those who govern us, not a command and control system, has now been thrown out because of fear of a disease that's a legitimate disease and something we have to be concerned about, but something that we have to address in a very, very different manner to protect those most at risk and allow those who are less at risk to make reasonable choices about relative risk and move forward with their lives.
Yeah, if you're 20 and younger, your survival rate is 99.99%. What we should be doing is protecting the old and the vulnerable, and then the rest of us should be living our lives. But the question I wanted to ask you is, how do we undo this? I mean, the fear, the distancing, these masks, I'm afraid that these 3- and 4-year-old kids that are walking around Chicago, they're going to think that that's how you have to live your life in decades to come.
Well, I'll tell you, my daughter's school was arbitrarily closed by our mayor here in Indianapolis on Thursday for no tangible
reason.
Scientific reason. I think that it's very obvious that the schools, at least the elementary and middle schools, the high schools, I think you can make a case perhaps for a blended model. But universities, many of them closed arbitrarily and quickly without any consideration of the risk that the students themselves face. And these young people are suffering real costs. I mean, they can't go out and get jobs. They can't lead their normal lives. They're losing educational years. And as you said, the risk to them is, at least as far as we know, is very, very low. And, you know, we accept risk in all aspects and all walks of life. And I referenced this in my piece that, you know, we make trade-offs with regards to risk. And if you decide to try to mitigate a risk on one dimension, you're going to increase risk on other dimensions. And so if you tell young people or you know, people in general who are much less likely to be sick from this thing that they have to stay at home and they have to, you know, homeschool their kids and they have to potentially lose their jobs and paychecks, that has all sorts of safety consequences for those people that policymakers are simply not considering right now.
It seems to me that half the country is happily skipping down the road to serfdom. And it's not just fear-addled. It's because they're fear-addled. It's also because they have gleefully accepted being lorded over by politicians to the point that no bad behavior by a politician is to be reckoned with. And I point yesterday to the Fox News affiliate out in L.A. reporting on Gavin Newsom and a bunch of California Medical Association people at the French Laundry having a heroic dinner where I'm sure they were game planning on how to save California grandmas and grandpas. We don't need a Thanksgiving. We just have to we should be fortunate and express gratitude, give thanks for their giving. That's enough. And it's the same thing everywhere. Thanksgiving meals are being shut down and regulations are being imposed in terms of how you live in your home. And frankly, with the quiet acquiescence of wide swaths of the population.
So let me just up your Hayek reference with another one. I guess my piece is the protection of the Constitution of Liberty in response to your road to serfdom.
Yes, nicely done. She just checkmated me. A Hayek checkmate.
One upper.
Well, you know, you got to play a drinking Hayek game.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll be back later, and in reference of use of knowledge in society. No, but I think what you've touched on is, in my view, the real risk here. Speaking as someone who's really more interested in the politics of this, the fundamental nature of a liberal society, and I don't mean left liberal. I mean liberalism through classical liberalism, through the great thinkers of the Western tradition, through the Enlightenment. Is really the result of individuals being recognized as having rights and responsibilities, right? So if that is what our society is founded upon, if that's the nature of how we govern ourselves, how we act in markets, how we live in society, then that takes a mutual respect and a mutual trust between the governed and the governors. And the problem is that when you see what happens in California, or when you see people getting haircuts like Nancy Pelosi, or when you see Republicans or really anyone engaging in hypocritical activity, and we have, you know, situations here in Indiana where our governor was seen, you know, hugging people in a selfie photo without wearing a mask. And then, you know, publicly he's saying, oh, yeah, you've got to wear a mask or else it's your fault. This kind of public shaming when the politicians themselves are acting inconsistently is really not productive. And it leads to all sorts of problems because people will lose faith in the governors. And when that happens, social order breaks down. And that's a risk to all of us. And it's not a risk that we need to live with. If, in fact, politicians treated people like responsible adults, let people assess their own risk and pursue those risks with a reasonable understanding of the rewards that come with those activities.
It's also such a tell, isn't it? I mean, how these men and women of science and data at the French Laundry, how concerned are they really about transmission?
Well, I think they understand that none of them. I mean, so I believe that the birthday party was for one of Governor
Newsom.
Yeah,
he was 50 years old.
Who's 50? And you know what's interesting? You know, I'll tell you something. So, and I cite this in my piece. So the CDC came out with a study on excess deaths, and excess deaths, there are about 300,000 in the U.S. as of October. Only 200,000 of those are directly attributable to COVID. Another 100,000 are attributable to other factors, some of which I infer, and I think it's pretty safe to say, are the result of the policies we're following. And those excess deaths are targeted to people 30 to 50. So, you know, when people like Governor Newsom and his friends, they go out and have dinner, they're there and they continue to lead their lives normally, and they go to gyms and they, you know, they engage in the sorts of lives that we're not allowed to engage in right now. They're preventing those deaths to they're preventing themselves from becoming unhealthy and following down that path of suffering from an excess death, while the rest of us are now more at risk as a result of these policies because we're not allowed to make free choices. So there's a double standard here that needs to be addressed, and it's about public trust.
I mean, the blatant hypocrisy is really just revolting because we have it here in Illinois. Our governor, he was going to head off to Florida unless we asked him, hey, what are your plans for Thanksgiving? He denied the stay-at-home travel advisory because he lives in the city of Chicago, said, you know, he didn't know about it, and then came out yesterday and said, oh, no, I'm going to stay here because we're in a crisis right now.
Well, I love
his wife and daughter are gone.
Yeah, well, that's lovely. Yeah, I hope they flew on a private plane.
Oh, they did.
I have to. Well, that's good. Good for them. I got to say, he had a quote yesterday or the other day where he said he was referring to the new tier that you guys are suffering through. He said, "This is not a stay-at-home order, but the best way for us to avoid a stay-at-home order is to stay at home."
I know.
I mean, that sounds like something Tony Corleone would say to one of his clients. I mean, it's really, that's not democratic governance. That's an open threat of autocratic governance. And again, it doesn't have to be this way. Right. I mean, have to recognize the risk and trust people to act responsibly.
But Chicago, Philadelphia, they say no Thanksgiving unless with your immediate family. New Jersey, no singing, no shouting. Pennsylvania, you have to wear a mask inside your house. But the CDC, I don't know if you saw this, no singing, but they want you to bring your own utensils. So if you do go to, say, your sister's house or somebody else's house, bring your own fork, knife and spoon. How ridiculous is that?
I think this gets back to this notion of what people, first of all, what they know and do not know. And so when risk becomes the driving force behind all policy, when we become driven completely by the precautionary principle, that never ends well because we become less resilient, we become less wealthy, we become less healthy, and also it breaks down society. So if I don't trust you to wash the utensils or the dishes, I mean, what does that say about my view of you? But also, what does it say about the way we understand the science? Because on the one hand, you're being told, well, you should wear a mask because this is an airborne disease. But it's also a disease that can be passed through touching. And there's a lot of uncertainty about this disease that is still being unraveled. And we shouldn't act as if these blanket statements are the way to go when we still don't have a complete grasp about how it's spread. We have good ideas about that, and we should probably follow some reasonable precautions. You know, there ought not to be 80,000 people at Soldier Field. There ought not to be 70,000 here at Lucas Oil to watch the NFL, and I think that's a reasonable precaution. But, you know, the idea that you bring your own utensils to Thanksgiving, I mean,
well,
that's great. Why don't you just wear a mask and a bubble, you know, like the boy in the bubble.
I've got a Tyvek suit I'm going to put on.
Yeah. The problem with that order, obviously, is it's wildly reckless. There is no reason to have a fork and a spoon when a spork will do. So it's just wasteful. And on Thanksgiving,
well, you could just use your hands too. That'd
that's
be
true.
A lot easier as
that's,
well.
That's quite,
yeah,
no,
you could,
no question.
With rubber gloves. Yeah, that would be very reasonable. And as far as mask wearing indoors, and that's how's that going to be enforced? Seriously.
It's not. I know.
I mean, of course it's not.
Yeah.
Well, until they come knocking at your door.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, I agree to the dismissive attitude towards enforcement, but at some point, if this goes on long enough, they may make an example of somebody. And then the real problem is when enforcement doesn't, in fact, occur. It's the same thing with businesses. They're shuttering. The real problem is when somebody rats out somebody next, you know, their next door neighbor in this lives of others culture they're promoting. And then somebody shows up to, I don't know, ask you to put your mask on because your neighbor's concerned that you're going to spread the virus in the neighborhood or, you know, some other safetyist nonsense.
Well, you know, and this takes me back to this trade-offs question. So on the one hand, this is a serious disease that certainly affects certain people and we have to take seriously. Does it merit the breakdown of trust between neighbors? Is it worth it for your neighbor to start snitching on you? Is it worth it? Is your neighbor at that much risk if you're engaging in certain activities? And is it worth the social costs that we're going to have to rebuild after this is all over? Which is not to say, you know, I'm in public. When I'm in public places, I wear a mask. When I'm in my workplace, we're required to wear a mask. I wear a mask. Those are the rules, and I think those are reasonable rules. And I don't want to make any of my colleagues sick. If I've got this thing, I've got some older colleagues. I don't want to be responsible for that. But the idea that neighbors are going to start snitching on each other, that kids have to be pulled out of schools, that individuals engage in activities that are borderline ludicrous, that has consequences that aren't just government. They're broader and deeper than that, and they will affect us for years to come in adverse ways.
Oh, well, I was underground man long before it became fashionable, so I say everybody join the alienation from society, and there I just came right back over the top with your Hayek reference with Dostoevsky, and you didn't see it coming.
Well, and you know, my Russian literature is not where it should be, so I'm going to have to brush up on that.
All right,
don't bother
good.
Coming on the show unless you get it
yeah,
up.
Yeah, you,
bump it up, all right?
Yeah, you do your studies, and then we'll have you back.
Okay, I've got to get my Solzhenitsyn out right now and start reading.
Very good. Good place to start. G. Patrick Lynn, senior fellow at the Liberty Fund, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
So, Dan, are you going to get a last workout in before they end the group exercise today?
Yeah, but first I wanted
to jazzercise.
Address you. I wanted you to hear this. This is a letter at Slate.com, their advice column. The question, am I raising a mansplainer? My son is almost five, and he's always been very voluble and also willful. Oh, very nice one. Mm. For the past few months, he's actually taken to interrupting us when we're talking, saying, actually, oh. He does this to both me and his mother, my spouse. Yeah, we got it. So am I raising a mansplainer? Knucklehead, who is the advice columnist for Slate.com, which is a leftist rag, yeah, talks about how annoying actually-ing is and how she had to get over it with her son, too. So the actualing, the mansplaining of a five-year-old, this is something else that needs to be corrected as we pursue the emasculation of men in the early stages, not just in school, but before school. Thanks to advice columnists like those over at Slate.com.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.